I know, because I've gone through the trial. In my first year of teaching, in my case it was 5 years from the time that I entered the novitiate, and I just loved what I then considered the religious life. The only distraction where I lived was the babbling brook. I'm not exaggerating. There was a flow of water and the chirping of birds. Beautiful. Then I entered the active ministry. What an experience. First of all, I was given 25 hours of teaching every week. And then other chores besides. In teaching, by Friday I had to walk around to keep from falling asleep standing up. And unless these first professed are taught to distinguish between fatigue, just plain exhaustion, physical, emotional, you name it, they're liable to mistake that for being tired of religious life. Fifth reason, these are from within the young religious. The heavy demands of the apostolate, which lead the first professed to neglect the interior life, and especially prayer. If you would ever read, as I did, the life of the young Martin Luther, shortly after his ordination and profession, he was so busy, he admitted in one of his letters that he didn't have time to participate in the divine office, which as an Augustinian he was supposed to, or even as a priest, to recite the breviary, the divine office. I should also add he was rushed through his formation. No wonder the forces of evil used him to divide the church. Sixth reason, from inside the first professed, the mistaken notion that the training that the religious had received until first profession was only a spiritual ideal, but that the real religious life is different. Oh, my friends, be sure, be very sure, that before your first professed are first professed, they have no illusions that they're being trained for the real and not merely ideal religious life. You know what happens? And many of the things that you're told they should do, they give up. Or they feel it couldn't have meant for now. That's why I didn't dare bring it along. But in the novitiate we were told to keep an examination of conscience booklet and mark down each evening how well we've behaved or how badly we've misbehaved. No credit to the speaker, but since my novitiate, I am happy to report I have kept an examination of conscience booklet up to last night, when I made my last night's entry at 11:05. We were told never to go to bed until we had made our entry. more than once I've got out of bed to make the entry. Our founder was a former soldier. Discipline, training. All I can tell you is that the novitiate practices are to be so taught and so understood that the religious will continue through life. Seventh reason, from within. Failure to seek counsel. Some people honestly believe that once they've taken their first vows, they've already also made their last dependence on someone who is going to counsel them. But this raises a thousand problems. As you can see, we gave ourselves only 45 minutes. I have a part four which we will not be able to do much about. Part four is how to cope. We will have to do this later on. Let me finish, however, the difficulties from within. Number seven, neglect of seeking counsel. This may be due to the fact that there just are not people around to give the counsel. There may be a lack of rapport between the first professed and someone in the community who would be capable of giving the counsel. I have over the years told superiors to make sure that every community in which there is even one first professed have in that community someone assigned, mind you, by the provincial or superior general to give counsel to the first professed. It may be the superior, it may be someone else, but it should be someone, and that someone ought to be capable, and of course, must be willing. And finally, still from within, the first professed, not being open, the lack of openness, in not opening one's conscience to others. Now, the ones to whom one's conscience should be open may be the confessor, at least the major superior, or the local superior, or at least open to someone who has some charge over me. What happens for lack of openness? For lack of openness, especially with superiors, the problems that a first professed may have will never be known. And as a consequence, the religious may be exposed to situations, put into the company of persons that may be simply too much for that individual's strength of character at that time. Or secondly, they may be put into situations which you might say they are strong enough spiritually, but for which they are not prepared either intellectually or in terms of skill or training. And as a result, because they've been taught to be obedient, they're going to be obedient, even if it kills me. As one religious told me, I want to resist unto blood. Those are beautiful sentiments. The point is, unless the person is open, those who are in charge of that person's disposition may literally put a person into a situation where it will be a matter of shedding blood. In any case, so far for number three. The fourth area is how to cope. First of all, in order to cope with the problems of a person who is already professed, and we distinguish between temporary and first profession and final or perpetual profession, the Church now prefers the language first and final rather than temporary and perpetual, although the constitutions allow for both. It means, therefore, that the first professed seeks direction from experienced and dedicated people who, first of all, have the time, secondly, the patience, and thirdly, the prudence. That combination, I submit, is not an easy one to find. The same person may have the time but not the patience, or time and patience but not the prudence. Secondly, regular spiritual conferences. They were prescribed, specified by St. Ignatius. For that there is no substitute. Regular spiritual conferences with individuals who are qualified to give the direction. I would see on an average of once a month, and I would add almost as a minimum. In other words, that once a month, the one who is already under vows confers for at least a half an hour or an hour at a specified time with one's spiritual counselor or director. These, as I think I mentioned last time, should be appointed by the superior. Ideally, the superior herself or himself in a man's community. But there must be someone who both has the qualifications and, I would say, has the gift, and therefore has the grace to assist people, not only by giving good counsel, but by being the source of grace to the individual being directed. Thirdly, regular confession. If I were to specify or choose the one practice that I consider most important in the religious life today, it is regular confession to a good, experienced, and dedicated confessor. I think it is worth mentioning because of its gravity. Some time ago, I was visited by a religious, stopped in to see me, who told me he had gone to confession, and I think I should identify the place, St. Peter's Church in downtown Chicago. As you probably know, when you go to confession there, you press a button and you walk into the confessional, kneel down and wait. He knelt down and waited. A priest came. He began to tell his confession. Said it was some 2 weeks ago and he had whatever faults he confessed. The confessor told him, "Sorry, I cannot give you absolution. You don't have any grave sins. What you've confessed is not enough for absolution. the religious argued. The confessor said, "Will you stop arguing with me?" So he left without being absolved. But being courageous, he looked up the rector of St. Peter's Church in the Loop. He happened to be in, told him what had happened, and the pastor rector told him to grow up. Doesn't he know this is a new church? Well, he thought it wasn't not that new. When the religious told me that, I asked him, "Do you know the name of the rector, pastor?" Yes. He wasn't sure of the spelling, but he thought it was like this. I called up St. Peter's with the young religious there. I went through a battery of secretaries and finally got to the pastor. "Are you Father so-and-so?" "I am." "Well, I am Father John Harden, a Jesuit from New York City, who happens to be in Chicago." "I understand," I told him, "that a young man came to see you commenting that the confessor in your church wouldn't give him absolution because he didn't have enough sin. And you told him, in effect, to grow up." So this priest asked me, "What do you want me to do about it?" "Well, I just thought I would tell you, because what you told this young man should not have been said." He began to argue with me. This is the priest. "Don't you know that the Eucharist now substitutes for confession?" "No, Father, I didn't know. As a matter of fact, I worked for the congregation for religious, half of the last 15 years. I've been telling religious, because the church tells them, at least every 2 weeks to receive the sacrament of penance." By that time I could tell he was scared. I didn't have the heart to tell him any more. All I can say is, unless religious make their confession, call it reconciliation, sacramentally, on a regular basis, your community will not only not thrive, it will not survive. That's why in some six nations in the 16th century, religious life disappeared. It was mainly the neglect of the sacrament of penance. Christ came to save sinners. Unless we keep acknowledging to Christ sacramentally that we are sinners, he is going to drop us. He will tell us, in effect, "I came to save sinners, but it seems you are not a sinner. I then did not come to save you." With apologies for number 3 in section 4 of How to Cope with the First Professed. Make sure they receive the sacrament of penance regularly and frequently. Fourth, on how to cope. Make sure the young religious have their priorities straight. Their first priority should be the interior life. And only then, their apostolic work. Of course, our apostolate should be prayerful, but the work is not the prayer. I believe the most important single word in the Latin language for the spiritual life is the conjunction et. of Saint Benedict, ora et labora, pray and work. Number 5. How to cope? Be sure that the young religious are being given a good example. I know of no problem unless it is past correction in a newly or young professed, which cannot be solved by good example in the community. Make sure that the religious give a good example. 6. On how to cope. Make certain that the life of prayer in the community is strong, because no matter what problems a person can run into in the religious life, those problems can be resolved by prayer. But if I enter a community, take my vows, get involved with work, and do not have the example all around me of praying people, I'm going to neglect the indispensable means of staying spiritually alive, which is prayer. 7. Make clear, I would almost say from the day of entrance, certainly, once a person has taken his or her first vows, make clear to the religious from the start that there is no such thing in the religious life as a temporary vocation. It is impossible to exaggerate the importance of that denial. There is no temporary vocation. There is only a permanent vocation to which a person can give a more or less generous commitment, which, if the person's commitment runs out, it may indeed be temporary. To identify one community, the School Sisters of St. Francis, Mother House, New York. One of the leaders in the secularization of religious life in the United States. One of their early changes in their rule of life was to change the expression from temporary vows to temporary commitment. No. Vocations come from God. Either they are permanent or they are not vocations. Number 8, and finally, clearly distinguish to the first professed the basic difference between a vocation from God and a commitment from ourselves. I know of no single distinction in the theology of the religious life that is more practically important. Why? Because we are all naturally prone to shed the blame from ourselves and pass it on to God. Vocation is a grace. Vocation is a call. Vocation comes from God in the person of Christ. Vocation on God's part is His free will towards us. He is exercising His choice in choosing us. That's vocation, otherwise known as grace. What's grace about the grace of vocation? It is a grace because it is something which depends on God's goodwill, on His generosity, in fact, on His preferential love. God loves some people more to those he gives what we call a vocation. On our part is commitment. Commitment is our response. Commitment is our acceptance of the call. Commitment is our free will responding to God's free will. His free will towards us is His grace. Our free will towards Him is our generosity. There is as much difference between vocation and commitment as there is between what God does and what we do. On our part, this response, called commitment, is to be done originally. Otherwise, a person wouldn't even think of becoming a religious. But it must be sustained. My definition of love, sustained choice. But my friends, all the hardship in love is in that word sustained. I keep loving God, which means I sustain my choice of God over what? Over all other beings, every other creature, including the one that I most love, whose name happens to be my own. We finally got to the end of section 15, number 3, the crisis of the first profess.